is the Cloud Enough Podcast, your launchpad for Amazon Web Services.
Welcome to the Cloud Enough Podcast. My name is Michael.
And my name is Andreas.
We are brothers and freelancers focusing on Amazon Web Services. We do technical coaching for our clients. We also do infrastructure bootstrapping and architectural workshops, for example. In this podcast, every other week, we discuss a topic related to AWS. And the clue is that one of us prepares the topic while the other one has no idea what we are going to talk about. So this week, it's up to Andreas to come up with a subject. Andreas, what are you going to present us today?
Yeah, so today we talk about advanced AWS networking, and especially we talk about typical pitfalls that you should avoid when designing a network architecture. So that's what it is about. Are you ready to start, Michael?
Yes, I'm ready and I'm very interested. So let's get started.
Okay, so all the topics that I present now, so I have five different pitfalls when designing an AWS networking architecture. And all of them I have observed from clients that we work for, where we consult to optimize their AWS infrastructure or to build that infrastructure up from scratch. So this is coming from the real world and just some pitfalls to avoid. So let's start with the first one. And by the way, before we start, so there's a blog post related to this podcast episode. You will find a link to that in the show notes. And the blog post includes a lot of architecture diagrams. So that might make sense to have a look at them when following this podcast episode as well. Okay, so but now let's get started. So the first thing I want to talk about is two different approaches to connect VPCs with each other. So a VPC is a private network defined on AWS. And the question is, how do you connect it with other VPCs, either in the same account or in other AWS accounts that belong to your organization or maybe even belong to a third party? And Michael, do you know the two options that are available to do so?
I think so. So we have VPC peering, which is around for quite some time, and which has some drawbacks, and I assume you're going to talk about them in a few minutes. And we also have the new transit gateway, which is basically also tackling this issue.
Exactly. So the two options, VPC peering and transit gateway, they have different pros and cons that I want to talk about. So first of all, you could think, and this was at least my assumption, that when I create a network architecture nowadays, transit gateway is the first choice. So that's what you think when you look at the news, when you look at the features that are coming out. So transit gateway seems to be the way to go. The thing is, before transit gateway, we had VPC peering. VPC peering means you can set up a peering connection between two VPCs. And that's quite easy to do. So you create a peering request. The other part, so the owner of the other VPC has to accept your request. And then all you have to do is you have to create an entry in your root tables to allow traffic flowing between those two networks. So that's very simple to do. The benefit of VPC peering is it operates somewhere on the virtualized network stack of AWS, so which means there is no single point of failure here. There's no machine really where this is deployed to, which also means that there is no limitations on the maximum bandwidth that can go over a VPC peering connection. So that's what VPC peering is about. So AWS added new features to VPC peering. One is that nowadays, we can peer between different AWS accounts, and there's even the possibility to have VPC peerings among or across regions. So you can peer VPCs that belong to different regions as well. So that's fine. So there's only one downside, actually, and this is if you have multiple VPCs, so let's say you have four VPCs that you want to peer with each other, you have to establish a VPC peering connection between each and every VPC. So basically, you get a lot of VPC peerings to connect all those networks together. And think about, you don't have four VPCs, but you have to connect 100 VPCs, then the number of connections grows substantially.
Okay, so this sounds like an exponential growth problem. But besides that, also something that I like to add, which is maybe obvious, if you connect VPCs, the IP address ranges are not allowed to overlap. So if you create a network architecture, keep this in mind that it makes sense if you maybe today or even in the future want to connect VPCs to ensure that the IP address ranges of the VPCs do not overlap.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a configuration point of view, the growing number of VPC peerings that you need when connecting more and more VPCs is definitely a problem, because how do you handle that? Yeah, how do you configure all of that? There's one other thing regarding VPN connections. So if you have to connect, for example, your corporate network with AWS, then you also have to set up a VPN connection for each and every VPN, because you cannot share the VPN connection among multiple VPCs here when using VPC peering. And there's no edge routing as well. So yeah, you really have to set up a VPN connection for each network. So that's kind of the problem with VPC peering. And then AWS introduced Transit Gateway about 1 year and a half ago. And this is now the second option that we have. So basically, VPC peering is still available, but we now have a second choice, which is Transit Gateway. So Transit Gateway is a gateway that you can use to connect up to 5,000 networks by default. So you can basically peer 5,000 VPCs with each other by using a VPC transit gateway. So that's cool. And the main difference to VPC peerings is you only have to attach each VPC once. So you attach the VPCs to the transit gateway, and then you can define routing tables inside the transit gateway. That makes sure that traffic is routed between those networks as you want them to be connected. So you can connect all VPCs with each other, so allow traffic flowing around between all VPCs, or you can even have more fine granular network structures where you have some VPCs are able to talk to each other, but they're not able to talk to other VPCs, for example. So that is possible with the transit gateway. Another benefit here is that you can also attach a VPN to a transit gateway. And then you can use that connection for all VPCs that are connected to the transit gateway. So the number of peering connection decreases a lot, and you only need one VPN connection to your data center. That's another benefit when using the transit gateway.
Okay, Andreas. So if you talk about VPN connections, does this also apply to Direct Connect?
Yeah, that's true for Direct Connect as well. So you can attach your Direct Connect connection to the transit gateway as well and share it among your VPCs.
Okay, so that's great. So I think you introduced quite a few benefits of using the transit gateway. So I assume there are also some some things that don't work quite so well. So what are the drawbacks?
Yeah, so The big drawback actually is what I have observed in a project, and this is basically there is a baseline cost for connecting a VPC to the transit gateway. So you pay $36 per month for each VPC that you attach to the transit gateway. So this is maybe surprising because all you basically do is you create a virtual connection between your VPC and the transit gateway, and you have to pay for that, even if you're not using it or you're not sending any traffic through it. So that's maybe an interesting learning here.
So if I understand you correctly, and if I connect 5,000 VPCs with transit gateway, I will pay $180,000 per month for the connection?
Yes. So it's okay. Just for them, having them connected. You pay on top for the traffic. So for the traffic that flows through the transit gateway, you pay $0.02 per gigabyte as well. So that is, by the way, true for the VPC peering as well. So costs for the traffic are the same between VPC peering and transit gateway, but the baseline costs of $36 per VPC attachment are quite interesting, I would say. And also important to note here is you're not only paying for attaching VPCs to the transit gateway. So the same costs apply for attaching the VPN connection. So for example, if you have four VPCs and one VPN connection and you want to attach all of them to your VPC, you pay 5 times $36, which is $180 per month, just for the transit gateway setup to be in place. So you may say that doesn't bother me. So we are an enterprise customer and that's fine for us. But if you are a smaller customer or costs are really important to you, that might be interesting to know upfront before you basically design your network architecture.
Okay, I see. So you mentioned when you were talking about VPC peering that there is no bandwidth limitation. Is this also true for a transit gateway?
Yeah, so that's where it's a little bit tricky. As always, or as often, the problem with the limitations on AWS is that they are not very well documented. And also AWS support does not really answer questions related to those, does not really answer those questions. So what you can say from the documentation is they say that the connection between your VPC and the transit gateway is limited to 50 gigabits per second. But there is an asterisk here, it's burst bandwidth. So yeah, we don't really know the baseline network throughput that we have here. And it's also not that clear. So it seems to be possible to increase the bandwidth by asking for a limit increase. But yeah, it's not really clear what the upper limit is here. So if you really have requirements for very high throughput, make sure you double check that before you build up your network architecture based on the transit gateway.
Okay, so I have one additional question regarding the bandwidth limitation, and I'm not sure if you can answer this because you already mentioned that it's not so very well documented. So does this limit, so this is not a transit gateway limit, it's a connection limit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the connection between VPC and the transit gateway.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not 100% clear. So if you really have a project that has requirements for more bandwidth, double check with an AWS solution architect or support and really make sure that they have written that to you that says they will increase your limits there if you really need to. Yeah, so, but I think the learning here is with transit gateway, compared to VPC peering, it can become quite costly. So I have come up with a simple pricing example. So for example, if you connect four VPCs with each other, and you have two VPCs that you want to connect to your on-premises network via VPN, and you have 1,000 gigabyte of traffic between the VPCs and 500 gigabyte of traffic that goes over VPN to your on-premise network, you will pay round about $150 when using VPC peering, but you will pay $280 per month when using the transit gateway approach. So basically, you always double the price from a networking perspective when using transit gateway instead of VPC peering. So I think the learning here is, as long as the number of VPCs that you have to connect is not maybe, let's say about, if that is not higher than 10, it's maybe not a good choice to use the transit gateway from a cost perspective. Of course, if you have thousands of VPCs that you have to connect with each other, it's not only the costs for the networking infrastructure, so transit gateway, it's also the cost for the complexity in the configuration and the VPN tunnels that you have to configure on the other side that need to be considered. But I think, yeah, it's important that transit gateway is probably only for big enterprise customers with complex networking infrastructure. It's not for everyone.
Okay, and this also kind of assumes that you are following a network architecture where you like to have private networks. So, I mean, there's like another kind of approach having everything public and making sure that you have strong authentication on the endpoints. So, I mean, that's also an option if you want to get rid of all this network complexity.
Sure. So in general, you could say we want to re-architect our whole systems, and basically we want to do the same approach that AWS is doing, and each service in our organization has a public-facing API that other parts can talk to. But I think in many organizations, this is far, far beyond what they're currently doing. It's probably not too easy to implement out of the box. But of course, there are complete other options to solve that problem. But if you want to connect private networks with each other, then this is what you have to think about.
Okay, Andreas. So I think that was the first kind of pitfall that you mentioned. So what's the next pitfall?
Okay, so yeah, let's talk to the about the next one. So we have written about that problem before, and also a lot of people have discussed that before us, but I want to bring it up here when talking about pitfalls in networking architectures, and this is the NAT gateway. So let's talk about that a little bit. So first of all, the AWS recommended networking architecture is that you split up UVPCs in so-called public and so-called private subnets. And basically, a public subnet is attached to an internet gateway, which means packages from the internet can flow in and you can establish internet or connectivity out to the internet from that subnets as well. The private subnet, on the other hand, does not have a route to the internet gateway, which means it cannot be reached from the internet, but it can also by default not reach any resources on the internet. And now the thing is, so that's the default network architecture that you have. So that's what's recommended when building stuff on AWS. And also security guidelines, security checklists will basically check if you follow these rules, if you place your databases, your application servers into private subnets and only load balancers and stuff in the public subnets. But there's a problem with that, because oftentimes you have, for example, EC2 instances in the private subnets that also need to establish network connections over the internet to third-party APIs or even to AWS services, for example. And the problem now is you need some kind of NATing to make sure that those resources in the private subnet are able to connect to the internet. At the very beginning of AWS, what we had to do is, some people might remember that, you had to spin up EC2 instances that were acting as so-called NAT instances. So they were basically with an IP tables configuration, NATing the traffic from the private subnet out to the internet. Luckily, nowadays, we have a NAT gateway for that. So that's a managed service by AWS that we can use to basically enable those outgoing network connections from the private subnet.
Yeah, so I can remember the NAT instance times. And what I also want to add here is the NAT instance is based on an AMI that is provided by AWS, and this is based on Amazon Linux 1, and it hasn't seen an update since quite a while. And also Amazon announced that Amazon Linux 1 will be end of life, I think it's June this year, or maybe July, something like this, like mid of the year. So my impression is that there's basically no NAT instance anymore, so the recommended way is using NAT gateways, which is interesting, because for small environments and also like dev and test environments, they are much more expensive compared to NAT instances. I mean, I know that there are lots of problems with NAT instances, that you have to operate them properly and make sure that network throughput is big enough for your workloads, but still we see customers where this increases the cost so heavily so that they change their architectures, because they spin up environments for every developer, for example. And if you have like 10 developers, then this could easily consume more than $1,000 per month for basically nothing. So that's also like an interesting development, I think.
Yeah. So that's exactly the thing. So the NAT gateway is the recommended option for having outbound internet connectivity for your private subnets, which is fine. In many scenarios, you basically will need that, and many customers deploy it to their VPCs. But what you have to know is you are adding costs to your network infrastructure. And one aspect is what Michael already mentioned is, again, there's a baseline costs for a NAT gateway. And this is $32 per month per NAT gateway. And what you have to know is you need to have a NAT gateway in each and every availability zone that you operate in, because otherwise it's possible that the NAT gateway that you have configured for a subnet is not available in case of an outage of an availability zone. So, for example, if you follow the recommendation and use three availability zones, you will pay $96 per month for the NAT gateways just to be there. So that's just the baseline costs. So that's one aspect of the cost that you add with NAT gateways. And that's what Michael mentioned. This is especially important if you spin up a lot of environments with isolated networking. So for example, for each developer or stuff like that. So then this gets a significant amount of money that you spend just on the NAT gateways being there. And the other thing is you not only add costs, the baseline costs, but also the traffic costs increase. So you pay around about $0.09 per gigabyte that is going out from an AWS region to the internet. And with NAT gateway, you're increasing that cost. So you're adding 50% to that costs, cost increase of 50% for outbound traffic. So you're not only paying more baseline costs for the infrastructure, but you also pay more for the traffic. And this can also cause troubles. So if you have a workload in the private subnet that needs to send huge amount of data out to the internet from the private subnet, which means it goes over the NAT gateway, then it's also not very economical to use a NAT gateway here. So that can also be a reason for thinking about not to use the NAT gateway. So what's the alternative? So in a dev environment, you might say you spin up EC2 instances for that. So that might be an option. But in other scenarios, it's maybe not really recommended to manage your own NAT gateways on top of EC2. So basically, the only option that you have is you can move your workloads from the private subnet to the public subnet, and maybe especially the parts of your workloads that have the requirement for high traffic over or outbound to the internet. Yeah. So in that case, it might make sense to move that workload from the private subnet to the public subnet, because then the instances can talk to resources on the internet without the need of any NAT gateway. And that decreases traffic costs substantially. So you can think about that. So we see many clients that struggle with that problem, and they then decide to move either the whole workload or parts of their workload to the public subnet. Of course, from a security perspective, you have to be aware that there is more risk with that configuration, because in theory now, packages from the internet can reach your EC2 instances in the public subnets. And of course, you can mitigate that risk, for example, or definitely you should have security groups in place that restrict incoming traffic very strictly. And you can also think about having network access control lists in place to have a second layer here that prevents data coming in from the internet to those instances. I know that it's still more risk than placing your EC2 instances in the private subnet. But that's, I think, the trade-off that you have to make here. So is it, from an economical standpoint, is it worth to place the instances or move the instances in the public subnet? Or do you want to pay for the NAT gateways here to have that layer of security, really. And yeah, we see both. So we see customers that decide we put everything in a public subnet and want to reduce costs. We see others that pay the extra costs for a NAT gateway to follow the security best practices and mitigate the risk here.
So I also think that one aspect that really motivates people to move their workloads into private subnets, no matter what the network costs are, is security tools that sometimes very simply follow rules and without questioning the rules. So if there's something running in a public subnet, they flag it as insecure, whatever that means, and then people are like alarmed and move everything in private subnets without considering the consequences regarding costs. And then over time, just their network bill will increase and they don't really know why. So yeah, I recommend that always take this advice from security tools with I think it in English you say with a grain of salt or something like this. So be suspicious and question the alerts that they generate, because very often they just create lots of alerts to make sure that you feel like insecure. So this tool is valuable. It has lots of recommendations. But yeah, you should sometimes question those recommendations, and very often they don't really apply to workloads on AWS, and there are better ways to implement them.
Yeah, but I think what these tools are doing is they just implement the recommendations from AWS or also from security checklists or security best practices that a lot of the industry is following. So of course, we're not using private subnets, you're not following those best practices anymore, and you have to be able to argue why you're not doing so in this scenario. And I think there are good arguments for that. Okay, so we have talked about transit gateway versus VPC peering. We have talked about the problems with NAT gateways. One possible solution is to move parts of your workload in the public subnet. And the next thing I want to talk is VPC endpoints. And Michael, maybe can you give a short introduction to what is a VPC endpoint?
So I think there are two different endpoint types. So the oldest ones are basically a way to make sure that you can connect from a private subnet to S3 and DynamoDB without going through the internet. So I think this is kind of DNS magic combined with some other magic. So you don't have to change anything in your application code. It will just resolve the DynamoDB DNS name to some private IP address, and then you can talk to DynamoDB without nothing. And then for some reasons, AWS stopped deploying those or stopped developing new versions of those kinds of gateways for endpoints, for other services, and they invented something new. And they, I think, work similar, but are more expensive. Maybe you can give us some more insights, Andreas.
Okay. Yeah, so in general, VPC endpoints, so that's what I wanted to ask you, basically. VPC endpoints allow you to talk to AWS services that only by default offer a public API. And those VPC endpoints allow you to talk to those AWS services without the need of going to the internet. So you have basically a private endpoint to talk to AWS services. Because that's maybe also not clear for everyone, most of the AWS services are not part of a VPC. So in a VPC, you deploy EC2, RDS, Elasticache, stuff like that. But there are a lot of AWS services. I would say the majority of AWS services just has a public API that you talk to. So examples are S3, DynamoDB, CloudWatch, SQS, Kinesis, and many, many other services. And the VPC endpoint now allows you to talk to those services without the need of going over an internet gateway, so basically without internet connectivity. So that's cool. So Michael, you already mentioned that there are gateway endpoints. So these are only available for S3 and DynamoDB. the big benefit here is they are free. So you don't have to pay anything for them. And that is why I highly recommend to add endpoints for S3 and DynamoDB to your VPCs and to configure the routing for the private and public subnets accordingly, because that decreases the costs for the outbound network connectivity over the NAT gateway significantly. So that should be a default in your network configurations. And now there is also interface endpoints. That's what AWS calls them. And the interface endpoints is the new way AWS has built VPC endpoints for many and most of the AWS services. For example, you can find interface endpoints for CloudWatch, SQS, Kinesis, and many other services. And the thing here is an interface endpoint costs $7 per month per availability zone. So again, you have to create an endpoint, or you should create an endpoint in each availability zone that you have deployed your workload to. So typically that's two or three. And so that is multiplying the costs accordingly. And of course, maybe that's something we have to mention here. You also can use a NAT gateway to talk to the AWS services with a public interface, public API. But then, yeah, the same limitations and problems apply that we have been discussing before. Okay, so what's the thing with VPC endpoints? So I think first of all, it's important you should add gateway endpoints for S3 in DynamoDB by default. And then the question with introducing interface gateways is how many AWS services do you need to access from the private subnets? So because the math here is basically you compare the baseline costs for an interface endpoint with the baseline costs of a NAT gateway. So, and the rule of thumb here is if you have more than four different AWS services that you need to reach from your private subnets, from the baseline cost perspective, it's cheaper to use a NAT gateway instead of interface endpoints here, because that's the $7 per month for the interface endpoint and the $30 per month for the NAT gateway. So that's what you need to compare here. Unfortunately, it gets even a little bit more complicated because the traffic over the NAT gateway is more expensive, about four times more than what you pay for the traffic that goes through an interface endpoint. So that means if you have AWS services that you use from the private subnet, with very high amounts of traffic flowing through, it might be then also cheaper to introduce an interface endpoint instead of using a NAT gateway. So you really need to do the math here. Basically, many services maybe do not course high traffic. So for example, if you just send a few messages to SQS, that's maybe not that interesting, but it could also be that the amount of traffic is so high that it's then, yeah, maybe cheaper to use an interface endpoint instead of a NAT gateway. So really do the math here when designing your network architecture and decide, do we need an interface endpoint or do we need a NAT gateway here?
So I have one question, Andreas, regarding the interface endpoints. So is there really a cost for gigabytes that flow through interface endpoints?
Yes. This is $1 cent per gigabyte. Yeah.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
So it's not for the gateway endpoints, for S3 and DynamoDB, but for the interface endpoints, there's a cost. Yeah. Okay, so this is another pitfall. So make sure you calculate what's best in your scenario to not overpay for the networking infrastructure. Okay, Michael, are you ready for the next pitfall?
Yeah, so I think there's... I mean, how many pitfalls will there be following?
Two
so
more.
I think there's two more pitfalls.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on.
Okay, so the next one is related to a CDN. So if you plan to add a content delivery network to your network architecture, then that's something you should be aware of. So what is a content delivery network? So a content delivery network is a global network of edges that is used to cache static content. So for example, our blog cloudonout.io runs by using a CDN, and we are using the CDN from Amazon, which is CloudFront here. And yeah, basically the thing is, if you are if your browser requests all the resources to show the blog on your in your web browser, those requests will hit CloudFront at an edge location nearby. So for me, it's basically probably Munich. Michael, for you, it's maybe Frankfurt, that where the next edge endpoint is. And the thing here is now that CloudFront is then answering the requests, if possible, by getting the content from the cache. So it does not need to really send the request to the origin server where you operate your web application or what have you. So that's why adding a content delivery network is, I think it's becoming a default to use that for modern web application, because it first reduces the load on your backend servers, and it also reduces latencies for the clients a lot, so that it makes sense to have that. So the thing here is, something you need to be aware of is when designing a network architecture, basically, or when picking the cloud, the content delivery network, is also cost related. So besides CloudFront, there are popular other CDN providers. So there's Akamai, there's Cloudflare, Fastly, to name a few. So many others that are out there. They have, by default, they have all that, the functionality that I've described. Some of them come with a lot more than that. So they have other features as well. So you might think of, we want to pick a content delivery network that fits our needs. And the thing here is, there's one thing that you have to keep in mind, and this is, on AWS, you pay for the traffic, basically, that leaves your VPC, and that basically goes from your VPC to the internet. You have to pay for that traffic. So this is round about $9 per gigabyte. And the important thing here that you need to know is, you have to pay for that when you use a third-party content delivery network. So basically what you pay then is, you pay for the traffic from, for example, your application load balancer to the content delivery network. And typically you also have to pay your content delivery network for the outbound traffic that then goes to your clients. The important difference here is, when using CloudFront, AWS does not charge for the outgoing traffic from the ALB to CloudFront, the content delivery network. So that is free of charge, the traffic here. And that's basically something you have to keep in mind when choosing a third-party provider here, is that when you calculate the costs, you have additional costs here that you need to think about.
Okay, so to make this a little bit more like practical, so basically, depending on the cost, okay, but usually you double the traffic cost if you use a third-party CDN compared to CloudFront.
Yeah, the question here is then, how much traffic is really going between the content delivery network and your infrastructure on AWS?
I see, yeah.
So if you can cache most of the requests for a very long time, it might not be impacting costs a lot, but it could. So make sure you calculate that upfront, or estimate that upfront at least. So that's important to know. Yes. Okay.
Okay, I see, Andreas. So it's time for the last pitfall.
Yes, the last pitfall. So the last pitfall is, again, more related, or more important for enterprise workloads, I would say, because it is also only a problem in hybrid cloud scenarios. So that is what the last pitfall is about. So it is about Route 53 resolvers. So what are Route 53 resolvers? So first of all, Route 53 is the DNS service of AWS. You can use it to manage domains, public domains. You can manage it to operate hosted zones. They can be public or private. And basically, it's all about DNS with Route 53. And when connecting your on-premise network with AWS, you will sooner or later stumble upon the problem that you need to manage DNS records for the resources on AWS. So basically, you want to have readable and names that you can remember for the EC2 instances and load balancers on AWS. And the thing is, the easiest way to do so, because it's integrated into AWS and also into infrastructure as cloud tools like CloudFormation and Terraform, is what you typically end up with is using Route 53 and a private hosted zone to manage the DNS names for your internal network, the VPC part. You use Route 53 for that. And now the problem is, or you have basically two problems. The machines running in the VPC, they probably also need to resolve host names of endpoints in your on-premise network. So that is what they typically need to do, is they need to contact an internal domain, the name server, an internal name server to resolve that host names. And you also have the problem in the other direction, that resources in your on-premise network need to resolve the host names from AWS. So for example, managed in a private hosted zone. So let's make an example. So you might have a domain name, let's say myintra.net. This is your internal network namespace, and you might decide to have aws.myintra.net for the namespace of the resources on AWS. And basically, you now need to make sure that you can resolve those names from both sides. And AWS introduced Route 53 resolvers to basically make sure you can do that. And there are two types of resolvers. You can have an inbound resolver. The inbound resolver is acting as the endpoint for or that the internal name server in your on-premise network forwards requests to. So you configure your internal name server to forward all aws.myinternal.net requests to the Route 53 inbound resolver. And then this part of the DNS side works. And there's also outbound resolvers that work in the other direction. So you basically configure the name server on the AWS side to forward all requests for myintra.net to your name server on premises to resolve those names. Yeah? So that is what you use Route 53 resolvers for. Does that make sense, Michael?
I think so. I mean, it sounds complicated, but I think I understand how it works. But so you mentioned that there is a pitfall. So what actually is the problem besides the complexity?
Yeah, good question. So again, the problem is the pricing. So we pay $180 per month for an inbound and also for an outbound resolver. So that's quite that's quite a lot, just for having DNS in place. So this is again the baseline costs. You also pay for requests, but I think what I want to talk here is the baseline costs, because that's quite impressive. So keep that in mind when adding those to your architecture. So two possibilities to make sure you're not creating crazy costs by using Route 53 endpoints. So the first advice here is you can share the outbound endpoints among multiple VPCs and even among multiple AWS accounts. So you can use the resource share manager for that. You basically can share the outbound rules and attach them to multiple VPCs, even in other AWS accounts. So by that, you can basically, you only have to pay once the $180 per month for the outbound endpoint and can use that for multiple VPCs and multiple AWS accounts.
Okay, so I have to attach this to every VPC, so this is not something that I could attach to the transit gateway?
Yes, you have to attach it to the VPC, I think.
Okay, that's a lot of work.
Yes, it's a lot of work. And also, I think the downside of sharing the outbound endpoint, outbound resolver, is, of course, you're then introducing a single point of failure. And usually that is why we use multiple AWS accounts. We use them to isolate the workload and to make sure that no one, by making a change to one AWS account, breaks something in other AWS accounts. So that's basically what you're giving up here to reduce the costs. Okay. Unfortunately, or for the inbound, side, there is, depending on how you set up your private hosted zones, you also can use only one inbound resolver. So basically, for example, you could have one AWS account where you manage the private hosted zone, and all other AWS accounts are allowed to make modifications to the records in the hosted zone, for example. And then you only need one inbound resolver to make that happen. So that's possible. It's also a lot of work to configure that, of course, and to make sure that works for all VPCs and so on. But it's possible in theory. Or I think there is also a complete other approach that you can use, which doesn't need an inbound resolver at all. Because what you can do in theory is you can just use a public hosted zone to also manage the records pointing to internal IP addresses. Yeah. So I know. So first people will say, oh, now you're not allowed to do so. You cannot have a public name server that manages private IP addresses. Okay. That's an argument. You could argue that an attacker can gain information from that public hosted zones about the private IP addresses. I would argue that's security by obscurity. It's not really that important, maybe. And also, I would argue that AWS itself is doing that. So load balancers, RDS instances, they all have private IP addresses that are resolved by contacting public DNS servers. So you already have that when using AWS. So it might not be a big issue. But of course, I understand the other argument as well. So that's, again, a trade-off between maybe following very strictly to security guidelines to the other side is having a more cost-effective solution.
Okay, I see, Andrea. So I think that is kind of the same argument that we have with public and private subnets here.
Yeah, similar one, I would say. Yeah, definitely. So if you really follow strictly the rules and best practices, that's a no-go. But on the other side, you can reduce your costs by almost $200 per month by not following the rules. So that might be worth the trade-off, or it might not be worth the trade-off, depending on your scenario, on your budget, and so on.
Okay, so maybe one note to our listeners. So if you think that, ooh, there are lots of pitfalls, and this is just like the networking section of AWS, I can highly recommend that you, if you're starting with AWS, or if you want to deepen your knowledge, check out our book, Amazon Web Services in Action. And it is published in the second edition, so it already got updated. And it covers a very broad service spectrum, so you will find everything related to VPCs, also security groups, but we will also go into details regarding databases, RDS, DynamoDB. There will also be some SQS, S3, and stuff like this in the book. We also talk about architectures that you can create to achieve high availability and all kinds of things. So if topics like this are of interest to you, then our book will definitely be fun to read for you as well, I think. Andreas, so besides my plug for the book, do you have anything else to add to the topic, a summary or something like this, or are we done?
Yeah, so one addition. So where can I buy Amazon Web Services in Action, our book? So you can buy it wherever you buy your books. So Amazon.com, your local book dealer, and you can get it directly from Manning, which is the publisher. So just search for AWS in Action and you will find all you need. Let me sum up our discussion of pitfalls when designing advanced AWS network architectures. So first of all, we discussed VPC peering or transit gateway. And the rule of thumb here is for a smaller amount of VPCs, maybe using VPC peerings is still the best options, or at least the most cost-effective option. Then we discussed the problems with the NAT gateway and one possible solution to move parts of the workload into the public subnet. We discussed VPC endpoints. So remember, there's the gateway endpoints, which are free of charge. There's the interface endpoints that allow you to connect to AWS services. But keep in mind that adding more than 5 interface endpoints is more expensive than adding a NAT gateway, which is the alternative here. So keep that in mind. Then we discussed the pricing of outbound traffic when using content delivery networks. So the outbound traffic from your VPC to the internet is free when using CloudFront, but you will pay for that traffic when using third-party CDN providers. So keep that in mind and calculate the costs for that before designing your architecture. And last but not least, we talked about Route 53 resolvers. So they are a great way to set up a hybrid DNS environment, but the costs are quite significant. So $180 for inbound and also then for the outbound resolver. So make sure to share the outbound resolver with multiple VPCs and maybe even AWS accounts. And maybe think about using a public hosted zone instead of an inbound resolver. So that's the summary of these AWS networking pitfalls that you should avoid. I hope you have learned something from this discussion. Thanks for listening. And we will be back in 2 weeks.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Andreas, for preparing the topic. And I am motivated to present something of similar quality in 2 weeks. So thanks very much for putting all the energy into this research. And if our listeners now think, okay, maybe I forgot something, then check out the show notes where you find the blog post link where you can read up the summary and all the details in case you missed something. Thank you very much, Andreas, and talk to you in 2 weeks. Bye.
Bye.